This is Donald Hussig with Loving the Earth Environmental Revolution. Joining us today from the University of Missouri is Dr. Frederick Vom Saal. Dr. Vom Saal is a preeminent, one of the world's most well-recognized endocrinologists. He's going to be speaking about bisphenol A science and lack of governmental action to protect public health. Good morning, Dr. Vom Saal.
Good morning, Donald.
Tell us about how you came to be this well-known BPA, well-known endocrine disruption, well-known endocrinologist.
Well, actually, similar to most people who work on endocrine disruption, I did not come out of a background in toxicology. I actually was studying endogenous hormones and hormonal drugs, and really stumbled into this field. And also a huge impact on me was meeting a person who wrote the book Our Stolen Future, Dr. Theo Colborn, who introduced me to the subject of endocrine disruption. And it was really working on natural endogenous estrogens and how they are important for normal fetal development that we decided to just test some environmental chemicals and compare them to estradiol. And we chose a number of chemicals to test that were known environmental estrogens, known to be estrogenic. And bisphenol A just happened to be one of them. And when we tested bisphenol A, we found that it bypassed a critical barrier system in the blood that is important for controlling the uptake of endogenous estrogens produced by the ovaries in females or the testes in males and also by the placenta. And this critical barrier system did not impact bisphenol A, which went right by it, and into cells. And as a result, the potency of bisphenol A, we were able to show, was being underestimated. And we published a paper in 1997 going through the details of how we went about discovering that and what the consequences were for development of the male mouse reproductive system, which essentially bisphenol A at 25,000 times lower than anybody had ever tested before disrupted development of the entire male fetus in the mouse. The reproductive system of the male fetus was disrupted. And that obviously led to an extremely aggressive reaction by the plastic industry that, first of all, offered us what I considered a bribe by saying, can we arrive at a mutually beneficial outcome where you don't publish this information until it's approved for publication by the plastic industry? And we told them in no uncertain terms that was unacceptable. Things have been going downhill in terms of my interaction with the chemical industry ever since.
Well, it sounds like you got a good start. Tell us about the big picture on BPA. We've spoken briefly beforehand. It's my understanding that there are approximately 1,000 scientific research papers on bisphenol A damages to health. Tell us what you can tell us in approximately 10-15 minutes, you know, the amount of time that we have here. Tell us about the scientific literature of bisphenol A.
Back in 1997, this was the first paper that we published showing what is called very low dose effects of this chemical that had really only been looked at in a few toxicological studies for very high dose acute toxicity. And this is, like most hormones, not a chemical that is lethal humans are exposed to. And so over the next 14 years, coming up to 2011, what has happened is that more and more scientists in different disciplines, in cancer research, in reproductive biology, in metabolic physiology, that is looking at insulin, glucose metabolism, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, immune system, neurobiologists looking at brain and behavior abnormalities, all these people that come from different fields, not from classical toxicology looking for just a few classical toxicological endpoints such as DNA mutations or overt death, for instance. All of these different fields are now represented in this very, very large literature. And one of the interesting aspects of industry becoming very aggressive about attacking the original research on BPA is it led to a lot of people being interested in it, and there has just been a flood of articles showing, you know, if you just start at the brain, for instance, neurobiologists have seen multiple changes in brain areas as a result of fetal exposure to bisphenol A, and associated with those changes in brain structure, there have been changes associated with those structural changes in the neurochemistry of the brain, that is, the neurotransmitters that control brain function. And those changes in structure and neurochemistry are related to behavioral changes. The behavioral changes are things like hyperactivity, impaired learning, impaired social behavior, impaired social interactions that are identifiable early in life in terms of play behavior being different, and then in adulthood, sexual behaviors and aggression and other social behaviors are also disrupted. Well, if you look at attention deficit hyperactivity disorder in humans, it matches the hyperactivity and learning impairment due to developmental exposure in animals to bisphenol A, and various aspects of autism spectrum disorder are reflected in the abnormalities in behavior that also see in animal studies. So one of the interesting findings, the most interesting from my perspective, is that the effects that are seen in these behavior and brain studies are virtually never the same in males and females. So that one of the most widely observed and consistent findings from neurobiology studies is that bisphenol A is reducing normal gender differences, so that where you see brain structures where there is a pretty big difference in unexposed animals in brain structure and brain function and in behaviors, those differences are reduced or completely eliminated by bisphenol A exposure during the period of brain development. And that's really very interesting that this is a chemical that seems to be able to interfere with the normal processes of gender development. So the next area that is, of course, tremendous concern and area that I'm working in is that developmental exposure to, again, amounts of bisphenol A that are relevant to the levels of exposure of humans based on a substantial number of studies monitoring BPA levels in humans, and then we monitor the levels of bisphenol A in experimental animals as we administer bisphenol A to them, and then look at the relationship of the levels we're generating in animals to the levels in humans. And one of the things that is seen is that bisphenol A alters the programming of the way fat cells function and makes fat cells more likely to incorporate fat into them as an animal ages when this exposure occurs again during the period when fat cells are developing in the early life, then throughout the remainder of life, these animals get heavier and heavier. They show, their pancreas shows abnormal insulin secretion. Cells in the animals show abnormal ability to respond to insulin normally, and you have abnormal glucose regulation. And all of this, of course, is what leads to type 2 diabetes. And we all know that type 2 diabetes is on a dramatic increase course, and also obesity is on a dramatic increase. And bisphenol A is related to both of them. And in terms of the reproductive system, in the female, developmental exposure to bisphenol A leads to abnormalities of the ovaries, where you have abnormal chromosomes in a female's ovaries, which means the probability of producing an abnormal baby would be increased by that with chromosomal damage. And one of the more scary findings is that in the embryo, a female embryo whose mother is exposed to bisphenol A, her ovaries, the baby's ovaries, are abnormal, contain chromosomal abnormalities, which means the pregnant female who produces a female baby is going to actually have grandchildren that are going to be abnormal because her daughter is going to have ovaries that have been rendered abnormal. So we're beginning to see what we call transgenerational effects here. And BPA also causes ovarian cysts, uterine fibroids. These are consistent with a disease in women called polycystic ovarian disease, and uterine fibroids are one of the major reasons women have hysterectomies. So on the female side, we also have a paper we published in 1999 in Nature showing that developmental exposure to bisphenol A leads to early puberty, as well as accelerated weight gain in mice. And in a number of animal studies, other people have seen early puberty as well as weight gain and other metabolic abnormalities, you know, as I've already mentioned. And on the male side, the entire reproductive system is rendered abnormal with developmental exposure to bisphenol A. And in particular, there's a permanent decrease in sperm production by the testes. And on the other hand, what you see is the programming of the increased likelihood of an animal developing prostate cancer. And on the female side, there is an increase in the probability of developing mammary gland cancer. So triggering of cancer in adulthood due to changes in the programming of genes in the prostate and the mammary glands. One of the interesting aspects of this is a few areas now, there have been human epidemiology studies that have provided information consistent with the animal data. For instance, recent studies have just come out showing that a mother's levels of bisphenol A during mid-pregnancy predict abnormal behavior in the female offspring. This, again, is humans. Learning abnormalities as well as increased aggression, but it's seen in the female offspring, but not the male. Again, you have this difference in response due to the gender of the baby, which is so commonly seen in the animal experiments. The other thing that is seen in human studies based on the United States National Health Survey, which is an ongoing survey by the Centers for Disease Control, is a relationship of the amount of bisphenol A in an adult's body and the probability of having type 2 diabetes and of being obese. And there are other studies relating a elevated level of miscarriage and polycystic ovarian disease to levels of bisphenol A in a person's body. And also occupational studies showing that people working in plants with that use bisphenol A have fertility, men have fertility issues, which is consistent with the animal data. So, you know, we're beginning to see a relation between findings about bisphenol A in human studies that match exactly what has been shown in a very large number of animal studies.
It sounds like there is a very solid, a very broad scientific basis for action by government, which has a responsibility to protect the public from exposures that are now known to cause diseases. It sounds like that there is a strong scientific basis. Let's go now to a discussion of what you have experienced in this realm of the science and your advocacy for action and government's lack of action on BPA to protect public health.
Well, one of the important things with regard to what you just said is I wouldn't consider myself an advocate in the sense that there are people in the non-governmental community, for instance, NGOs, who lobby and who look to try to impact legislation and would, you know, then be advocates for a position. And from the point of view of science, the scientists who are involved in this are advocates for the government paying attention to the published science. So the disturbing aspect for me has been the disconnect between this massive amount of science and the regulatory community that is built on a tradition that comes out of the past 70, 80 years or so of toxicology that basically makes assumptions that you, in order for regulatory agencies to be able to use a scientific finding, it has to conform to a set of standards that is knowledge of medicine to treat it, as opposed to 21st century knowledge of medicine. And so what you've had is a whole bunch of federal regulatory agencies, essentially the Food and Drug Administration, the European Food Safety Authority, basically say, well, we acknowledge that there are these hundreds and hundreds of studies that indicate harm at very, very low levels of this chemical, but we are going to reject all of them and only take a few studies published by the chemical industry as valid studies for risk assessment, and based on them, we're going to tell the public that this chemical is completely safe at the levels that people are being exposed to it. And that leads me to one thing I didn't mention, and that is in response to our study in 1997, industry has since commissioned about 15 studies, spending millions of dollars on them, and 100% of them conclude, even though it's not always what the data show, 100% of industry-funded studies conclude bisphenol A is completely safe. So if government agencies only take industry studies as the basis for making the determination about the safety of BPA, then they can tell the public BPA is completely safe. And the scientific community, and there are now 8 major scientific societies led by the Society of Endocrinology, a medical and scientific society, that have said to the United States government regulatory agencies, this is not acceptable. This is a very serious problem. And what is interesting is that the Food and Drug Administration's Science Advisory Board was harshly critical of the Food and Drug Administration making a determination that bisphenol A was completely safe based on just evaluating 2 industry studies and completely ignoring all of the information I just outlined for you. And the Science Advisory Board told the FDA, your conclusions are not based on valid science. And essentially, the European Food Safety Authority's conclusion that was identical to the FDA's, based on, the same approach, we're just going to use a few industry studies, the European Commission rejected their conclusion and voted to legislation banning BPA in some baby products. So what is happening is that our federal regulatory system has really failed, as it did with tobacco and lead in paint and so many other hazards. It has really failed to operate properly. And so what has happened is in the United States, for instance, we're up over 10 states now have successfully passed legislation about BPA. We're essentially replicating with BPA what happened over a decade with tobacco, where cities and states had to take legislative action to deal with the issue of secondhand smoke, for instance, because the federal regulatory system was incapable of doing that.
Well, I find this very interesting because it's a mirror of the experiences that our organization, Cancer Action New York, has had with POPs. There's a very similar story. This vast basis of scientific knowledge, all these thousands of research papers on dioxins and PCBs and brominated flame retardants, a very extensive scientific literature, and yet government, the Food and Drug Administration, the European Food Safety Authority, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the World Health Organization, none of those public health entities, those governmental health entities, have done what any reasonable person, you know, a knowledgeable, a thinking person would do. With this scientific basis, they have not done the simple, taken the simple action of warning the public of the avoidable disease hazard. It's both a cancer hazard, a diabetes hazard, and a cardiovascular disease hazard, this total POPS exposure. These governmental entities, they will not address this. And I'm thinking that the same basic explanation exists for both of our issues here. Your concern about the BPA and government failures, and our concern about the POPS and government failures. We believe it is all because the corporations rule at the higher levels of government. Certainly the state and national levels of government, no matter where you're at in the world. And because of that, we don't get science. We get corporate interests determining government actions.
One of the fascinating aspects here is if you read the FDA's criterion for stating that a chemical is safe, it is, the statement is, it has to be based on a reasonable certainty of safety under the intended uses in terms of the estimation reached by competent scientists. And if you look at an NIH statement, an NIH meeting on bisphenol A in 2007, publication by 38 internationally recognized scientists, and the conclusion was, at current human exposure levels, extensive evidence exists for harm in laboratory animals, raising extremely strong concerns that a similar kinds of hazards could be caused by BPA in humans. And over the last 4 years, we've had all these epidemiology studies that have, in fact, been confirming in humans what we've been seeing in animals. And even given the criterion that the FDA is supposed to be operating under, they are not telling the American public that bisphenol A is unsafe. And yet their mandate is they're supposed to do that. But the second part of it is that you have regulatory or at least various kinds of agencies like the World Health Organization that isn't really a regulatory agency, but is, you would hope, a public health advocacy organization. And they put together a panel in 2010 that I was on and actually ended up resigning from because I disagreed so strongly with the conclusions reached in the report on bisphenol A that was recently released by the WHO. And one of the problems is that we have a bunch of industry-funded research that is created to, as David Michaels in a book called Doubt Is Their Product, based on a memo written by a tobacco industry lawyer who said, our job is to create science that we can use in court to create doubt. And that process works beautifully in terms of the way that the WHO and other organizations like them reach decisions, because if there is not complete consistency, regardless of source of funding, which clearly creates tremendous bias, as we know from the tobacco litigation wars, if there isn't complete consistency in the data, they state in their report, there is great uncertainty conscious about conflicts of interest and live in a world where conflicts of interest are taken very seriously, the idea that agencies such as the WHO would not be weighting evidence based on who paid for it and, oh, is this a company that makes billions of dollars on this chemical, and shouldn't we take that into account in assessing the validity of their conclusions? And the answer is no, their conclusions are taken as equal to any other conclusion, even though they are in a tremendous minority of the total literature. The fact that there is conflicting information has led in this report to statements of, oh, there is great uncertainty about the consistency of the findings. So industry has this strategy that works beautifully in terms of federal agencies accepting industry research as unbiased when it's absolutely clear that most industry studies are designed to fail. And if you know enough about the science, that is extremely obvious, and it's actually something I've written quite a number of articles about, taking apart the industry studies in detail and showing how they are profoundly flawed. And anybody who knows anything about science should be able to detect and deal with that type of misbehavior.
It seems to me what we're talking about here is not a matter of the government scientists, the government, because there are many scientists who are employed by the federal and state government health entities and regulatory entities that do have a role in making these kinds of decisions that you're talking about that the agencies make, these failed decisions. It's apparent to me that really we're talking about the government being the corporations. There's such a huge amount of influence that the corporations exert that government has, in my mind, and the mind of many that I associate with, government has become nothing other than another face of the corporations. It explains everything that you've just related to me and every experience that I've had with government and failure to act upon science, because everything is done to please the interest of the corporations, regardless of the science. Does that make sense to you?
Well, if you look at the Food and Drug Administration and the Vioxx drug scandal that finally a FDA regulator by the name of David Graham blew the whistle on the FDA because it's been shown that as many as 100,000 heart attacks possibly could have been prevented if the FDA had taken action on Vioxx, given the data it had. And he said on a PBS interview that Vioxx was not an exception, that the FDA had gotten to a point, and this is not me saying this, this is an FDA regulator who quit under whistleblower status, that the FDA had become an agency that was treating its regulatory agency, its regulated corporations, as clients, and it had become an advocate for these corporations rather than a regulator of them. And all I can say is that, I think the current administration of the Food and Drug Administration has, came in, looked at the rejection of the 2008 risk assessment that claimed BPA was completely safe and that was out and they said to the public something that the average person in the United States doesn't understand, and that is that they said we recommend trying to avoid BPA to the extent possible, but if we tried to take regulatory action, we would need new legislation or rulemaking authority in order to be able to do that, because BPA, along with about 60,000 other chemicals, is beyond our regulatory reach due to the fact that these chemicals were grandfathered in when all the current laws governing chemicals were passed, and they're essentially outside of the reach of federal agencies to regulate them. And in Europe, a new set of regulations called REACH has been enacted by the European community, where for the first time, chemicals used in products have to be tested for their potential health effects prior to being put into products. In the United States, chemicals are put into products and they have to be shown to cause harm at the population level. In other words, there has to be extensive exposure and extensive harm before they can be taken out of products. And so you take a chemical such as BPA, for which there is now just a staggering amount of scientific evidence of harm, and we have a federal regulatory system that actually doesn't have the authority to do much about that. It's Congress has played around for years trying to redo our chemical regulatory laws, and industry, while saying, oh, we need a coherent set of laws until they're watered down to the point where they're of no value whatsoever, the laws that have been proposed so far haven't been able to get anywhere through our federal legislators. And just like all other problems we have with the group that's in Washington. And so it's really been at the state level that chemical regulation has been occurring, because our federal regulatory system is broken.
We could not be in more agreement. I've heard this from so many preeminent scientists. Dr. Jeanette Sherman, she stated to me and the members of our organization that we should not be looking to the federal government for this POPs, this persistent organic pollutants exposure minimization education of the general public, that we would not see that coming from the federal government. And see, now we're not even talking about this matter of regulating, that they cannot even educate, they can't even present a message to the public that is based on science and that would minimize harm that's resulting from this contamination of the earth with the persistent organic pollutants.
Well, the other part of it is the regulatory system is dominated by a group of people called risk assessors that come out of a tradition of toxicological chemical risk assessment that does not apply in any of its fundamental assumptions that are used there to estimate whether chemicals pose a risk or not. They're all based on ideas that actually go back to the 16th century and are completely out of touch with modern science. And this is where the scientific and medical societies are saying to the FDA and the EPA and other federal regulatory agencies, you need to open the door to scientific societies providing expertise
Exactly. Exactly. This is what we have experienced with the group of chemicals referred to as dioxins and dioxin-like compounds. When the US EPA did its, well, it's continuing to do it, it's been doing it for 20 years now, this current draft of the dioxin reassessment, they produced a cancer risk assessment, a quantitative estimate of how much cancer is caused by any particular amount of dioxin exposure. And they state that this is in the realm of the magnitude of 1 in 1,000 excess risk from dioxin exposure based upon exposure to 1 picogram of dioxin TEQ per kilogram body weight per day. And yet this only looks at the exposure of factory workers, adult male factory workers, no use of any knowledge about gestational exposures to dioxins or lactational exposures or adolescent exposures, nothing for women, just adult males. And then they put this before the public as if this is the amount of risk that any human being would have from exposure to the levels of dioxins that exist in the food supply at this time. Very, very bad.
And it's even worse than that, because there are thousands of articles now on dioxin. This dioxin risk assessment has been used as a political football for now 21 years going on. And one of the disturbing elements to people who do the kind of research I do is that all of the other huge number of adverse effects caused by dioxin in terms of reproductive damage, brain damage, damage to all of these other organ systems, none of this information, it's just like bisphenol A, none of that information is being used to arrive at a reasonable estimate of, what do we know about this chemical, what are its risks, what is the kind of total information that should go into that. And what they're doing is they're zeroing in on only one part of a very big picture. As you identified, they're ignoring all of these other types of exposures of fetuses, which is a huge problem. But they're also ignoring a huge amount of information about other kinds of harm caused by this chemical. And that clearly is a political decision. It's not a scientific decision. It's scientifically irrational from a public health perspective. It's completely irrational. And to have our regulatory system operate in that kind of a situation where people are looking at what they're doing saying, this makes absolutely no sense whatsoever other than to protect polluting organizations, that's really disturbing.
It certainly is, and we say viva the revolution to them. This is what we're saying. We believe that there has to be a revolutionary change in the world, and in the United States, more so than in many other places. There needs to be a time come upon us. We need to be part of a time when these changes take place quickly, and they take place to the extent that the people in government and the people in corporations who won't use science in a way that is protective of the environment and the public health, that they step down, and they relinquish their positions of power, and they leave government and corporations so as to make room for people who will use science to protect public health. Because in the end, you can make all the money in the world, it will do none of them any good in any kind of significant way if people are sick, and they are sick, and they will get sicker as long as this is done the way it's being done right now?
Well, one of the arguments that some people make is that if chemicals in the environment were a problem, we'd see people dying earlier. And one of the things that that ignores is that if you look at disease trends such as breast cancer, which is now 1 in 8 women, dramatically different than it was 50 years ago.
Certainly.
Obesity rates doubled in the mid-1990s. Type 2 diabetes, that never occurred in children. There are now clinics just for children with this disease that used to be called adult onset diabetes. You know, when you look at these kinds of things and you see a set of diseases that are clearly implicated in terms of detailed experimental studies showing that chemicals in the environment contribute to them, may not be the only factor, but they're certainly contributing factors, and they're factors that can be dealt with. And if you remove a contributing factor, you're going to reduce disease. And from a public health perspective, we have clear information that humans are being impacted by chemicals that can cause a wide variety of harm. And the important element of that is that when you can identify those chemicals and remove them from commerce, you are going to make everybody in the world healthier.
Healthier. This is so beautiful. Someday, I am certain that you and I and our organizations and the colleagues we have, this is what people want, and I'm certain it will become the reality once we overcome those that don't want it that way. This has been a wonderful interview. It's so good to know that there are people with your not only intelligence and hardworking behaviors, it's this matter of being ethical to the point that it's ethical enough to deal with all of those who are doing business with no concern for public health. Takes a lot of ethics to stand up to that. I'm sure you have encountered lots of pushback, lots of negativity from the chemical corporations. Honored to Dr. Vamsal.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you and being on your program, and I wish you luck in your endeavors to try to improve the public health.
Thank you, Dr. Vamsal. Have a great day. This has been Loving the Earth, Environmental Revolution. We want everyone on Earth to start caring, to start thinking, to start acting, calling upon government and corporations to either do the right thing now or give up the power, because there are people who will use the power for the benefit of everyone.